You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 3rd of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. This is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
We are ensuring that we will have a Ukraine that stands strongly on its own feet, militarily, economically, democratically.
Antony Blinken has been in France. We'll hear more about the concerted efforts of Washington and Brussels on handling two major world conflicts and the dangers facing Europe when the EU disagrees. Charles Michel, president of the European Council, has been in Lithuania alongside some other European leaders as the Eastern Balkans eye their borders with the bullish Belarus in growing alarm. We'll have the view from Vilnius. Then, from incarceration to inauguration, we'll hear about the newly elected president of Senegal. We'll discover a ceramics workshop in San Francisco, have a hit of business news and a roundup of the world headlines. Plus...
Pozdrav svima, ja sam Nitkolina, u isto vrijeme postojim I ne postojim. Nešto kao I lajkovi na strani...
New Croatian politician or newly created politician? That's the voice of Nitkolina, but... Is she real? We'll find out. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. A 7.2 magnitude earthquake rocked Taiwan today, the strongest tremor to hit the island in at least 25 years. NATO foreign ministers meet today to discuss how to boost military and financial support for Ukraine on a long-term footing. And the White House has directed NASA to establish a unified standard of time for the moon and other celestial bodies. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been in France meeting with Emmanuel Macron to discuss the mounting international crises in Israel and Ukraine. He also had talks with Foreign Minister Stéphane Séjourné and the two held a press conference yesterday. Well, from Paris, I'm joined now by Anne-Elisabeth Moutet, who's a French journalist and a columnist for the Daily Telegraph. Anne-Elisabeth, many thanks for contributing to the show today. What was said at the press conference?
At the press conference, everyone in France noticed was how Antony Blinken seemed to be less bullish than Emmanuel Macron in saying there is no question that American troops will not go to Ukraine. Emmanuel Macron, about 2-3 weeks ago, said something that was a sort of great departure from his previous stance on Ukraine, saying that nothing could be ruled out, including, that was on 26 February, nothing can be ruled out, even sending troops on the ground. And then he justified this by saying that when you are dealing with someone like Putin, you need to preserve some part of ambiguity on what we could do. He was contradicted by NATO, mostly, and the Americans are doing exactly the same thing. And I think, we are in an electoral situation in many cases. Emmanuel Macron wants to sound extremely different from the national rally. And in America, the question of Ukraine has been completely sort of weaponized by the Trumpian right in saying that it was going too far. I suspect that actually they are in better accord on most things, and I don't think either that anybody said that a country should send troops to Ukraine at a specific time, but there are NATO troops surrounding Ukraine in countries that are NATO countries, and France, for instance, has got troops in Romania, and those troops in Romania are in a NATO country, and they're doing maneuvers in a NATO country. That is supposedly a non-story, but it's also true that Russia has eyes on parts of Moldova, and the presence of NATO troops so close to what might happen is also a message.
Mm. Now, Macron and Blinken may be in accord, but what about Macron and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz?
That is the great sort of désamour. I mean, they don't like one another. They don't understand one another. Olaf Scholz is an extremely different character to Macron. He's also the most left-wing chancellor of Germany possibly ever. And when of this, I mean what used to be West Germany. He does not want the idea. He's got all the 1970s and 80s German attitude. He's against nuclear power. He's against helping Ukraine. He is against a number of sort of viewing Russia as a threat. That's for what happens. And he's against. He's got the pacifist views shaped in the 1980s that do not look to Russia as an enemy. And he's also, the green agenda is actually very important to all parties in Germany. But the way Olaf Scholz has been managing this looks a bit like what Gerhard Schröder, who ended up being the president of the Russian gas company in Germany, we're getting our energy from Germany. We do not want to be independent. We certainly do not want nuclear power. And that's sort of the gist of the opinions. But the other thing is their styles are incredibly different. It's not the first time that a French president and a German chancellor have got different styles. If you take someone like Angela Merkel, she was certainly very, very different to Sarkozy. But they still made this sort of a structural alliance between France and Germany the motion, sort of where the motion of the EU bloc was going, and that's almost done. There's a kind of, the French feel that there's a kind of hole between them and Poland at times, political hole, and that's Scholz and Germany.
Mm. And in terms of the difference and the differing attitudes of France and Germany, is this, could part of the reason be because France's presidential system allows the president far more powers than the German system?
It absolutely is, because and sometimes there's misunderstanding in France as to how decisions at the end of the day in Germany are taken by the Bundestag and by the regions. But as it happens, there have been many instances in which the Bundestag was perfectly in alliance with French views, and it was the Chancellor himself who was breaking. If you listen to even the parties within the coalition in Germany, see, it's a three-way coalition with liberals and the socialists and the Greens. And the foreign minister is far more bullish than the Chancellor. It's not something that's insuperable, but it's something that's been weaponized. It's seen in Paris by the Chancellor himself.
I mean, are we looking at the breakdown of the Continental Partnership? And if so, what would that mean for the security of Europe?
We are looking, and we've been looking for some time, to a realignment of the continent. It's very interesting that Friedrich Merz, the leader of the opposition in Germany, who might be close to power because there will be elections at the latest next year and possibly this year if they call, there's a snap election. And he said that Germany stands between two important countries in Europe, Poland and France, and Germany is lost between these two. These were very strong words of support to Ukraine. They are certainly also heard by the Greens. It's just a kind of eclipse right now, but it may not last forever.
And if France and Germany are not in lockstep, what are the ramifications for Ukraine?
Oh, the ramifications for Ukraine are disastrous, because at the end of the day, Ukraine is providing most of the weapons and most of the financial aid. And actually, Germany has been very good about this. But in terms of weapons, there has been a dragging down of feet, which ended up being fatal for Ukraine, because eventually weapons like tanks and planes were sent, but 6 months too late. And when the Ukrainians needed tanks, they were getting nothing. When they needed planes, they were finally getting tanks, where the army had sort of moved, the war had moved into a different way. And that has meant an extremely difficult situation for Ukraine, because they did not have the hardware and the equipment to prosecute the war the way it needed to be prosecuted. And that's the reason why the last summer's offensive were stalled. They did not have the hardware. They even have it even less because also America in an electoral year is sort of locked in Congress again, for crucial aid.
Of course, Blinken, in this press conference in France, did address weapons. He talked about NATO and a lot more support for Ukraine. He also spoke about Israel and Hamas. What emerged in the French-American discussions on Israel and the situation in the Middle East?
The situation in the Middle East is complicated because, again, we are in an electoral year. It is not. It doesn't help you in France to sort of bring any kind of support to Israel. And Emmanuel Macron, to some extent, is aware that no Arab country neighboring Israel is actually unhappy to see Hamas being destroyed, and they are far less squeamish than Western public opinions. But essentially, there have been lots of good words, and one can imagine the support is going on. We know that America has made all sorts of noises about a ceasefire. We know that right at the exact time when this meeting was happening, the day before, there had been, 2 days before, there had been an Israeli bombing that killed NGO workers. So it is an extremely complicated and heated situation. But I would imagine that on this one, and what came out of it, the French and the Americans are actually much more in accord than they sound in public.
Anne Elizabeth Moutet, thank you very much indeed. This is The Globalist. It's 9:13 in Vilnius, 7:13 here in London. France and Germany are not the only European countries debating the future of Ukraine. On Tuesday, six EU leaders gathered in Lithuania. This comes as Belarus has begun military drills along shared borders with Ukraine, Lithuania and Poland. Well, I'm joined now by Professor Margarita Zsielgyte, who's Director of the Institute of International Relations and Political Science at Vilnius University. Margarita, many thanks for coming on the show. Who was at this meeting, and was it an official EU gathering?
I think it was a snap gathering, which included the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Mark Rutte, the head of the European Council, Charles Michel, and then the heads of the Czech Republic, Sweden, and Bulgaria. And the host, obviously, was Lithuanian President Gitanas Nausėda. It was a snap meeting as well. There was no much information in the press before that. So I would say that you have to look at this meeting rather from the electorate year perspective. There are a lot of elections happening in Europe and in Lithuania. In Lithuania, we have three elections in a row, European Parliament, presidential elections and parliamentary elections. There is a European Parliament elections in Europe. And of course, Mark Rutte is running for the NATO Secretary General. So I believe that when you look at who's at the meeting and what is the agenda behind, election matters a bit.
Yeah. Now, as we know, Lithuania is one of three Baltic states in northeastern Europe, and it has a border with the Russian enclave of Kaliningrad, and it's a key member of NATO's eastern flank. It's been a member of the military alliance for 20 years. How much NATO activity is there in Lithuania at present?
Yeah, it is quite present, and it's been growing, increasing since 2017 when we first got Enhanced Forward Presence Battalion in Lithuania stationed with Germany as a framework nation. But ever since, as you know, the security situation around us has aggravated. The war started in Ukraine, and then we had some issues at the border with the Belarus. So now, a part of the Enhanced Forward Presence Battalion, we have the implementation of the forward defense measures, which were affirmed at the NATO Madrid summit, and also reinforcements in a form of exercises are being also organized in Lithuania, for instance, that is very important for us because air defense is one of the weakest spots of the area of the Baltic region in terms of defense. We will be hosting for several weeks the long-range air defense missiles Patriot offered us for by the Netherlands. So it is also very important for Lithuania and for the region. And I believe that this visit of Mark Rutte also is partly related to the reinforcement of the Lithuanian, and not only Lithuanian, but broader speaking, regional security situation, security context.
Mm. I wonder if you could tell us about the significance of the Suwalki Gap.
Yeah, it is a very significant strip of the land, which is around 100 kilometers, and it's between, it's in Poland, and it's between Kaliningrad and Belarus. So this is the access for the NATO reinforcements to enter the Baltic theater if we have a conflict and we need NATO reinforcements. For a long time, this was the only access possible for the defense of the Baltic countries. But now when Sweden joined NATO, there is another access that's a Gotland Island. So we will have the access from the sea. So this significant of Suwalki Gap has been reduced a bit and we feel safer. Moreover, since 2017, there's been a lot of reinforcements in this particular region, in the Suwalki region. So that's also an important step forward in defending Baltic states.
And I wonder if there are concerns or expectations in Lithuania that Putin will invade the country.
Well, the people are anxious. If you come to Lithuania and talk to an average person, I guess there is a lot of anxiety in the society. But it is also related to what politicians are saying. And politicians now, as I mentioned at the beginning, there is an electoral year in Lithuania. So this narrative of the potential war happening in Lithuania is quite strong. So I believe that there is a lot of discussions in the society, but also in among the decision makers about the potential scenario. It's not that they are saying that this is, you know, there is a probability of 80% or 90% that we have this war, but the potential invasion is still possible, and we are talking about the about it as a possibility rather than probability, that if Putin is not tamed in Ukraine, that might be the next move.
Mm. And I wonder how unified the Lithuanian government or even the opposition are on what should be done to counter Russian aggression.
I believe they are quite unified, and their security and foreign politics is not a big dividing issue in Lithuania, and even in the electoral debate when the parties are fighting amongst each other, I think that security is the line that they mostly agree on, and there are a lot of discussions on increasing defense budget, and now we're speaking not only 2% that Lithuania meets the NATO requirement, but 3% and beyond, and the discussion is basically going on about the agreement among parties in written, and also talking with other members of the society, the business, how to achieve this increase, where to get the money.
Mm. Do many Lithuanians have Russian roots? Is there much connection between the citizens of the two countries?
Not so many, because, well, when you look back at the history of Lithuania and when we have liberated ourselves with the demolition of the Soviet Union, we had a pretty small 6% Russian-speaking minority in Lithuania and 5% or 6% Polish-speaking minority, as opposed to Latvia and Estonia, where these minorities reached up to 25%. So this is a minor issue for Lithuania. But when you look at the potential links with Russia, I have to mention another thing, that we are hosting around 15,000 Russians who fled from Russia before the war and after the war, and also a bit bigger number of Belarusians who fled Belarus after the war and before the war. So this is, I think, the issue of concern rather than the Lithuanian Russians who lived in Lithuania for many years.
Margarita, thank you very much indeed. That's Professor Margarita Jeschelite there. Now, still to come on the programme.
Nature is better designer than any human, but it doesn't mean humans need to compete with it. If we can absorb, understand, reflect, and I hope my work is bringing all these things together.
We'll head to San Francisco to meet a world-renowned ceramicist. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
It is 7:22 here in London. You're listening to The Globalist, coming to you live from Midori House. I'm Georgina Godwin, and we're going to continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio, my old friend, Steve Crawshaw. He's an author, he's a journalist. He was formerly Human Rights Watch UK director. I don't know what to call you now, actually.
Writing a book, I suppose. Very pleased to be here, above all, and writing a book about war crimes and justice are some of the themes we'll be discussing now.
Absolutely. Well, let's start with that and Israel and, of course, these dead aid workers. And all of the newspapers are picking up on the response to this, the fact that it happened at all, and what Israel is saying now.
Yes, exactly. So a lot of the British front pages, interestingly, we've seen Western governments, including the British government, very, very reluctant to criticise Israel in a whole range of different contexts. And we're seeing the headlines of the Times, outcry aid workers' death. We see the Daily Telegraph, Prime Minister demanding answers. And meanwhile, I was interested in a piece in Haaretz, which I strongly recommend that people who are interested in Israel and Middle East things do read, that Israeli voice, an Israeli liberal voice, which really gets some really interesting points there. The headline, one of the headlines, they're obviously running a number of stories, but one of the headlines that they're running with is Israeli army sources say Gaza aid workers killed because IDF force officers, the Israeli Defense Force officers on the ground, do what they want. Very shocking sense there of the impunity which is built in, which the Israeli government, of course, denies completely, but we have seen already there's a number of investigations going on.
Absolutely.
So I think this may prove to be a very big moment. We'll see.
And just talking about Haaretz, they do a really good email every day.
They do.
The war today, what you need to know.
They do.
And very much, I find that the coverage very balanced, actually.
I think it's very, very interesting. So I'm just back from Israel and West Bank myself, and it's fascinating to watch because it does give you, definitely gives you a different view from a lot of the mainstream pro-Israeli coverage, but also gives that real Israeli nuance and perspective that things are often a bit more complicated, frankly, than some of the easy reporting, if you like, from the West tends to do.
And in terms of your own trip, what did you see there that you feel was really relevant to how this situation is developing?
Well, I guess the very obvious things, but it feels more dramatic when you're there, is just how depressing it is, how incredibly, obviously this was a fractured place in any case, but the horror of, on the one hand, 7th of October and the massacre and the horrific things that too often get forgotten in some of the discussion at the moment. They're really horrific. And I was down in the south at the site of some of those massacres. And in parallel to that, the horrendous stuff that's happening in Gaza. And that's meant a real fracturing. Even those who had very good dialogue before, everybody, not everybody, but almost everybody has retreated a bit into their own community, if you like. And that's obviously going to make it even more difficult for moving forward, even if those who so badly want to be on the same page as each other are feeling not understood the depth of their own pain by the other side. That was one of the biggest things I took away from it.
Now, you've also been in Kyiv recently, I know. Let's have a look at Ukraine, increasing attacks, and also finally been passed into law, this lowering of the age for conscription.
Yes.
But this has been on the books since last May, I think.
It's been there for ages. It's kind of interesting. It's yes, Süddeutsche Zeitung in Germany has this, but many of the papers across Europe are flagging this. As you say, it's been around, and Zelensky himself didn't want to say yes to this pulling down. And of course, what it's really about at some level is where the hell is this war going, and where is the morale in Ukraine around this war? He didn't want to do it because it sends too much of a signal that things are going badly. And as listeners may remember, he got rid of his commander-in-chief just a few months ago. Partly, the general reckoning is that the commander-in-chief had sounded a bit too gloomy when he talked about stalemate. And Zelensky, for political reasons, didn't want that to happen. So, yes, it's been striking to me that, and indeed anybody who's been there, and we're seeing it from the outside as well, back in the spring of last year, there was significant optimism in Ukraine. I mean, things were terrible in many ways, but they achieved a number of victories against the Russian forces.
And you were there at that time.
I was there at that time. So I was there several times in the spring and then was back in the autumn. The change between the 6 months or so between those several spring visits and the autumn visit was very, very significant, because instead of it being a winning narrative, we've defeated them in Bucha and elsewhere, we've defeated them in Kharkiv in the northeast, we've defeated them in Kherson in the south, and now we'll have the big push in summer, spring 23. In fact, of course, that didn't really go anywhere. And in the meantime, that's had both morale knock-on effect of like, okay, things are hard. They're very much outgunned, the Ukrainian forces. And then the brutal, brutal truth that goes with that, and it really shouldn't, but it does, is that Western politicians, Western governments are like, oh, well, it's getting a bit harder, and therefore we don't want to support you exactly when that support's needed. Mm. And of course, the prospect of a Trump victory, it worries Ukraine deeply, to put it mildly,
because absolutely.
Yeah, his arrival almost makes game over in some ways. Perhaps not, but yeah.
Well, NATO's looking at this.
Exactly.
They're meeting today. They're going to discuss how to put military support for Ukraine on a long-term footing, but also they are looking at how to Trump-proof
yes.
aid for Kyiv. But I mean, of course, that aid from the US in particular has to come through first.
Yes, exactly. I thought that was a really interesting phrase. Like the idea a few years ago that you would need to proof yourself against the US president and his kind of various crazinesses. But you're right. As you say, it's being described as the Trump-proofing. I think that's great that they are thinking in those terms. But we also know, of course, it's not just Trump. Trump says it out loud, frankly, the things that some of the other European politicians and some of the NATO members are saying a bit more sotto voce. So it is a difficult time. What the Ukrainians, of course, continue to say, as do the Balts that you've had and the Poles and others who are closer to Russia and have that historical experience, say, you don't understand, this isn't just our battle, this is for everybody. But I'm not sure that message has got through more generally.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, Trump is always in the news. and we're looking particularly here at his legal problems, his financial games, because there's a lot of reporting on that.
There is. I mean, Trump is, as I'm sure he's happy about this in some ways. You always have such a multiplicity of Trump stories going on at the same time, all of which include him being happy to be in the middle of discussion. We've got twin stories running at the moment so a Guardian headline, for example, in their print edition this morning, Trump avoids asset seizure after posting $175 million dollar bond in his civil fraud case. So that's the Stormy Daniels case to do with alleged hush money. And then separately, at the same time running, Trump tries to remove judge from the hush money trial for the second time. So we've got, on the one hand, I think a lot of these things of trying to remove the judge and a lot of the other fusses are him trying to push again and again and again away. There's so many trials, which in the general headline understanding was, well, this makes lots of problems for Trump. In some ways it does, but because they are tending to clash with their timetables, he's hoping that it won't actually be done and dusted by the time we get to November, in which case he can kind of start again from carte blanche. I think many people are hoping that he's wrong in that calculation, but that seems to be the basic calculation. And on the money, we have this quite strange one where he appears to have lots of billions, which are his because of the float of his media operation. That's just lost billions of dollars. But again, it doesn't actually mean necessarily the end for the moment, because part of it is to do with optical illusion, basically, and his supporters are happy to sustain the optical illusion in a ways that many of us around the world may be puzzled and dismayed by, but that optical illusion continues for sure in some voters' minds.
And what are the polls saying?
The polls are saying, Well, one puts one's head in one's hand at this point, several percentages ahead, points ahead still. So it's, I think, 43-40 or something was that was some of the, 46-43 perhaps it was. And we've got the wild card of Robert Kennedy Jr. still in there. But basically still a bit ahead. If you're looking for optimistic bits, there are bits where Trump has stumbled as the election gets closer. Sometimes it seemed to go down. I still feel slash hope that somehow something will be pulled out of the bag. But we saw what happened last time. There was a very strong liberal centrist and moderate conservative consensus like, oh, he can't possibly win. He can't possibly win. In other words, the time when he legitimately won two presidential elections ago. And in the end, he did and took everyone by surprise. No one's going to be quite that surprised. So obviously a lot of pre-thinking is happening. Mm-hmm. But I hope that that energy can be found, that enough people may not fall in love with Joe Biden, which is clearly not going to happen, but at least think we'd be better off with this rather than that. But we'll see.
Absolutely. Finally, let's have a little look at the French Parliament, because they want to test Westminster-style Prime Minister's questions.
They do. So we've got Gabriel Attal, basically the Prime Minister since January, who's the kid of the young whiz kid, the youngest head of government, I think, at 35 or so is he, and very, very media friendly himself, and clearly thinks this can be a good idea. I'm not quite sure the British-style parliamentary questions is ever going to take off. I mean, British parliamentary questions is a kind of almost a social phenomenon, really, which goes back to kind of the British university debating style. It's almost not about facts and really holding somebody to be account. It's fundamentally about good debating style and whether you can skewer, and the Prime Minister and the opposition leader and their advisors spend almost the entire week planning brilliant one-liners which will skewer the other side. And the British society has kind of got used to that. People do watch it. But I guess one plus on it, if it does work, is that it is true that the televised version of that, which has been televised for, you know, a good few decades in Britain now, has made people more interested in the parliamentary process. It also gives people abroad, I think, quite an unreal sense of what's happening in Parliament sometimes. I've seen news programmes elsewhere saying, oh, there was a real drama in the British Parliament today, because they see lots of people shouting and yelling. Well, that's kind of what they do every time the Prime Minister turns up. That's kind of hear, hear and boo-boo is what they do. So I think that bit is not great, and I'm not sure it will ever take off. But if we're seeing more of the public getting interested in what they're seeing on screen, then of course that's a good idea.
Steve, thank you very much indeed. That's Steve Crawshaw there. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. A 7.2 magnitude earthquake rocked Taiwan today, the strongest tremor to hit the island in at least 25 years, killing one person, injuring dozens, and sparking a tsunami warning for southern Japan and the Philippines that was later lifted. NATO foreign ministers meet today to discuss how to put military support for Ukraine on a long-term footing, including a proposal for a 100 billion euro five-year fund and a plan seen as a way to Trump-proof aid for Kyiv. And the White House has directed NASA to establish a unified standard of time for the moon and other celestial bodies, as the United States aims to set international norms in space amid a growing lunar race among nations and private companies. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Days before the Senegalese election on the 24th of March, Bassirou Diomaye Faye was in prison. Yesterday, he was inaugurated as Senegal's youngest president. The victory came after three tense years and deadly unrest in the traditionally stable West African country, with many fearing Macky Sall, who'd been in power for 12 years, would try and cling to office. Well, joining me now is Mary Fitzgerald, Monocle's North Africa correspondent. Mary, many thanks for coming on the programme once again. I wondered if you could start by giving us a sense of the country under Macky Sall and how the lead-up to the elections, particularly the last 3 years, played out.
Well, I was in Senegal last September on assignment for Monocle, and what was very clear to me at that moment was there was enormous frustration regarding Macky Sall's rule. As you pointed out, he'd been in power for 12 years. There was enormous frustration and discontent amongst young Senegalese who felt that he prioritized foreign interests, foreign business interests in particular, over local interests. And Senegal, like other countries in the region, had experienced an exodus of its youth trying to get to Europe. So there was very much a sense of frustration and discontent, which was being tapped into by opposition figures, quite populist opposition figures, foremost amongst them Ousmane Sonko, who is the mentor of Faye. And so there was a sense that something was brewing. The government tried to push back on this kind of populist surge by jailing Sonko, disqualifying him for running for elections. But there was very much a sense that in the run-up to elections, a lot of things could happen. And when Macky Sall announced earlier this year that the election, which was planned for March, was to be delayed until much later this year, there was a groundswell again of anger. And we saw protests, deadly protests, similar protests had marked the last 3 years or so. So there really was a sense that something was brewing. Senegalese were demanding change. And what I was struck by with Faye's inauguration speech yesterday, he described his victory. He won 54% of the vote in the first round, so a sweeping victory. He said this showed that there was a demand for what he described as systemic change in Senegal.
Now, he's appointed his key backer, as you say, Ousmane Sonko, as Prime Minister. Just tell us a little bit about their relationship and how the two ran the campaign, because it seemed that they were very much modelling it on a kind of US presidential campaign.
Indeed. So what's striking about the two men is both are in their 40s. Faye is 44. Sonko is 49. Sonko has been Faye's mentor for several years and quite a populist platform. I mean, both of them are left-wing, pan-Africanist, populist rhetoric, talking about essentially taking back control, a lot of talk about sovereignty, a lot of talk about reinventing the relationship with France, the former colonial power. One of the main issues in their campaign platform was basically reforming or abolishing outright the CFA franc system, which many Senegalese consider a relic from the colonial period. It's a West African currency that's pegged to the euro. And what I was struck by, because, you know, a lot of questions in foreign capitals now about who Faye is, what will his policies be, both domestically, but also internationally, particularly at a time when we're seeing intense geopolitical rivalries across Africa, many questions about what he's going to do. And what I find interesting is on this issue of reforming the CFA franc system, in Le Monde yesterday, Le Monde cited French officials saying, we can actually discuss this. You know, this is something we're willing to have this conversation about reform. So this is really interesting that already we're seeing shifts in that direction.
And finally, how important will a stable democratic Senegal be in influencing the region?
Extremely important. West Africa has been roiled by coups and unrest in recent years. So Senegal has always been kind of considered a beacon of democracy in the region. Of course, the unrest we've seen in recent years has marred that reputation in many respects. But one thing I found fascinating is yesterday, and he has mentioned this in other statements as well, Faye talked about wanting to bring back Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso, three countries that have experienced military coups or led by military juntas with young leaders. He talked about wanting to bring them back into ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States. So it's interesting that he's already offering the hand to these leaders. Also, something that Paris is watching very closely, given its close bilateral relations with Senegal, is that Faye has talked about how he's open to new partnerships, including security partnerships. And the Russians, and this was very evident for me in Dakar last September, the Russians are seeing opportunity, possible opportunity amid this kind of anti-French sentiment that we've seen spread across West Africa in recent years. So that's another thing I think worth watching. And certainly Paris will be following that closely.
And do we get the impression that Russian influence would be welcomed?
So, as Le Monde noted yesterday, FI has not ruled out Russian partnership. I think I think it's fair to say that he is he's a political amateur. I mean, the fact that Sonko has appointed Sonko as his prime minister, I think, gives us a sign of how their relationship will play out. Sonko would be considered by far the more experienced politician, but I think that basically what they will do is leave this open and create an ambivalence to help them reform the relationship with France. Last year, FI told Le Monde that he basically, it wasn't a case of being against France, but for Senegal. And he said, we want what he described as a win-win partnership with France, a more equal partnership.
Mary, thank you very much indeed. That's Mary Fitzgerald there. And this is The Globalist. To San Francisco, where Heath Ceramics, stretching back over 70 years, occupies a storefront in the Mission District, housing and producing world-class ceramics sold around the world. It's where you'll also find a ceramic tile factory, bakery, bar, newsstand, and the studio of designer, ceramicist and director of the Heath Clay Studio, Tung Chiang. Monocle's Tom Webb went to meet him there to find out how he's continuing the legacy of the brand.
I grew up from Hong Kong and moved to United States around 2000 and starting second career as industrial designer and self-taught as a ceramicist. And then eventually around 2012, I started working at Heath Ceramics as the clay studio director.
And how did your time working in industrial design shape how you approach the world of ceramics?
Industrial design gave me a lot of foundation necessary information about how things being made. And there's a lot of aspect about like it's a customer consumer product. So the relationship about the consumer understanding who they are, how they use things is really important. So this is basic skill set of technical aspect. But yet at the same time, you understand the user behavior. That said, those information grounded in me, but oftentimes I put it down on the really bottom of the drawers. What I find often is interesting to me is that because I grew up in the advertising world as a creative director in Hong Kong, I found what is most important is that you should have a unique voice and point of view. That is what eventually, not just about learning from the audience, but it's about as a maker, what you can tell them that is slightly different. So I'm combining all these aspects together, eventually bringing to Heath as a ceramicist and designer. And eventually it's about almost like a personal journey. Is that like how you bring personal life experience, yet at the same time, professional life and experience together to weave my work together.
And you have a background in industry design. You come from Hong Kong. You're in San Francisco, two very big urban environments. But you are still inspired by nature and the natural environment. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
I think it's interesting to compare San Francisco to Hong Kong. I will say that, like, growing up in Hong Kong, San Francisco is a nature city, even though it's covering with all this tech aspect currently. But yet at the same time, you go through Golden Gate Bridge, seeing this beautiful sunset, the mass ocean around you, the unspoiled land that is still roaming on the highlands and stuff like that. For me, that is the amazing part. I grew up in this compact concrete city in Hong Kong, living in a high rise. All I want is a little rabbit in my gardens. And sometimes I will have like so many chickens and ducks and like animals in my balcony that is looking out to the high rise. That connection of the animals and wild is always there, but I didn't get to explore it when I was young in Hong Kong. When I first moved to Los Angeles, I went to Art Center. I select Art Center because actually it was on top of the hilltop. And when I interviewing the campus, there's a deer walking past the lawn. And I was like, wait a minute, can I study here? I'm going to be hanging out with wildlife. So that is the draw of the attention. As a designer, I find inspiration of nature is very interesting. The nature inspires human for the longest period of time. I think a lot of people will agree that like the nature is better designer than any human. But it doesn't mean humans need to compete with it. If we can absorb, understand, reflect, and eventually be part of the nature, I think that is our job, to continue connecting this connection, especially in the world that right now we feel crazy and wild with all these human conflicts around us. I think people forget to look around, is that it's not human-centered world, it's a world. And I hope my work and eventually the connection eventually is bringing all these things together.
And let's get technical about how you bring that all together. In the world of glazing, that's very much where your identity can come across in the work. How do you approach the process of glazing?
Glazing is a chemistry. It's eventually is a functional aspect that has been developed and understood for longest time. But yet, at the same time, if you look deep into it, A is about a human interfering, but also invention. That means you can always find flaws. You can always find not think of yet. No matter how well the development of the glaze, if you can able to like remove every human thinker or the process that have been applied to it, and we invest them almost like the first time a human looking at glaze, I think that is oftentimes is my starting point. Especially when I'm working with a factory that has 75 years of experience. Our expertise on glazer, one of our glaze specialists, Winnie, she has been working with us over 50 years now. She's inside out like library of glaze for me. But if you learn from her is one aspect of it, but you can always push her aside as well and say what you've done may not be the only way. What if you try something new? So there's a way that I can see glaze is that, what if I removing all this knowledge and start fresh? What does that mean to me? What if I using every knowledge that I already gathered? What it impact me is another way. And then the third element is that once you break it down, eventually glaze is a mineral. When you fly over from the plane, you look down, seeing the earth, the texture that you see from like 5,000 feet to when you are hiking in the wood, that you look down from your head down to a few feet away, you find so many similarities. The nature has a strong hand to dictate what they want it to be and also allow the element to change it. I'm trying to use all of this to inspire my work. But at the end, once I'm able to use the nature to mimic something that I feel like is look-alike, that is only the first step. What is important to me is that once I reinventing or reinventing a new process, I want to keep pushing. Break down the relationship. Not is just about mimicking the nature and eventually pushing out to a new direction that nature may find. What if I want nature inspired by me as well as I inspired by the nature? So there's a two way of thinking about it.
Monocle's Tom Webb speaking to the director of Heath Clay Studio, Tung Chiang. This is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
And it's time to talk business with Isabel Hamilton, senior reporter at The Daily Upside. Isabel, tell us about Amazon and their Just Walk Out technology, which seems to be proving unpopular.
Yeah, well, Amazon is going to be removing Just Walk Out technology as it builds new stores. It's not going to be ripping it out of the ones that exist. And Just Walk Out technology is, if you go into an Amazon grocery shop, you can just pick things up and leave. You don't have to go to any kind of till or kiosk to pay for your things. But there's not really a clear explanation as to why they've decided not to install this going forward. There was a quote from an Amazon representative to, I think it was Bloomberg, which seemed to imply that maybe customers aren't really that happy with it. Maybe they find it a bit strange, a bit creepy. But it's interesting because for Amazon, this was meant to be a really big innovation. You know, when they come into, they like to sort of disrupt things, but they seem to have worked.
No. Something else that isn't working as planned is electric cars. We thought this was the new wave that everybody would buy one, and it seems not so much as sales are falling.
Point. And lots of automakers that, you know, are traditional automakers have scaled back their electric vehicle production plans. But if you're Tesla or if you're BYD, which is China's biggest rival to Tesla, that's not an option. And they've had a really disappointing first quarter. Tesla's deliveries are down 8.5% compared to a year ago. That's the first drop in deliveries that they've had since 2020. And they're blaming the disruption on the Red Sea. You know, shipping going through the Red Sea has been sort of blocked by the troubles in the Middle East. Also, their Germany plant had to shut down, partly because of those Red Sea disruptions, but also because they had an arson attack. But it's still really, really disappointing quarter for them. One analyst called it an unmitigated disaster.
Isabel, finally, there's a TV ad starring Dominic West has been banned. This is about a bank. What was wrong with it?
Yeah, so this was an ad for Nationwide, which had Dominic West, who your listeners might recognise from The Crown. And in it, he's sort of satirising other banks and he's acting like this heartless big bank boss. And the kind of point being made is that Nationwide is a nice, friendly high street bank that won't shut down branches. But the ad got complaints because Nationwide has shut down branches. And Santander, one of their rivals, was one of the complainants. They have shut down fewer branches than Santander. But now the Advertising Standards Agency says, yeah, you can't run that ad anymore because it's misleading.
Isabel, thank you very much indeed. That's Isabel Hamilton there. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio. Two weeks today, Croatians will be going to the polls in parliamentary elections, and there have already been campaign shenanigans involving the questionable use of social media. Now, one opposition party has come up with a response. It's created an AI-generated politician to fight against what it calls misinformation in the digital space. And this is what she sounds like.
Pozdrav svima, ja sam Nitkolina, u isto vrijeme postojim i ne postojim. Nešto kao i lajkovi na stranicama HDZ-a, no za razliku od taktika kojima se služe naši politički protivnici.
That's the voice of Nitkolina, and Monocle's man in the Balkans, Guy Delaunay, can tell us all about her. Good morning to you, Guy. What is the story with this AI-generated politician?
Well, Nitkolina there was giving an introduction of herself. She was saying that she is the holder of an imaginary digital constituency and claiming to be the first Croatian AI politician. I exist and do not exist at the same time. Something like the likes on the HDZ pages. And this is a reference to the governing HDZ party in Croatia, which was caught out with one of their social media posts, which had a lot of likes on it. And when people looked into it, they discovered that it looked awfully like these likes came from AI bots in Vietnam. So the idea of Nitkolina basically is she's pointing out that, you know, there's a lot of shenanigans that can be pulled off with technology during the election campaign and people need to be wise to it.
So is she actually running as a candidate?
No, she's not, because you have to be human in order to do that. And the thing is about Nitkolina. Now, people may be aware that Nitkolina is a common name across the Western Balkans and Croatia and Serbia. But Nitko means nobody. So Nitkolina is a nice little portmanteau there, which sums up exactly what she is. She's kind of an empty vessel. And she's the idea of this party called Možemo, which is a green left party, who are quite an interesting player in the campaign because they actually hold Zagreb on the capital on a municipal basis. So the mayor of Zagreb, Tomislav Tomasevic, is from the Možemo party. They're polling reasonably well in the pre-election polls, not enough to form a government by a long way. But they've said, you know, they're willing to be a player in any governing coalition. So they're a serious player here. And they're a grassroots movement. A lot of them are very young, They know their way around technology, and they're saying, in essence, nobody's going to pull the wool over anybody's eyes while we're around. We want to help people see through any manipulations on social media.
And what, are they trying to point out that deep fakes are possible?
Deep fakes are indeed possible. They say there haven't been any of them yet in the Croatian campaign, but there have, as I've mentioned, been those, you know, dodgy shenanigans on social media where, you know, the bots have been out in force. Mm. And you know, we've seen deep fakes in other campaigns recently. So last December, in Serbia's parliamentary elections, one of the pro-government TV stations, TV Pink, was merrily running. And these were, again, to the casual eye, shall we say, fairly convincing deep fakes of opposition politicians saying deeply unflattering things about themselves. And Pink TV was trying to pass this off as satire. But the regulator, the media regulator in Serbia, took a dim view of it, which is, you know, the media regulator in Serbia is not really held in the greatest regard by the opposition. But on this occasion, the media regulator slapped it down. So we've seen AI-generated politicians deployed, deepfakes deployed in election campaigns in the region. And Mojim will say they're concerned that as polling day approaches, the likelihood is higher that you'll have these sort of deepfakes appearing on social media. And maybe on regular media as well, if Serbia has anything to go by.
And is there a danger that Nikolina will be taken for a real politician?
I would say, Georgina, that she falls into uncanny valley. And so if you look at the Instagram posts which she's been making, there's something slightly off about her. But then you could say that about Liz Truss as well, couldn't you, frankly? You know, so, I mean, I must admit, when I first saw her, I was like, gosh, you know, that's fairly convincing, but there is something definitely slightly off, and Mojim will say that's deliberate. They don't really want anybody to think that she is a real politician, that she's a real candidate. But the issue here is, of course, you can do deep fakes better than that, and Mojim will say they themselves, the coders within their ranks, can do better than Nikolina, and that's a bit troubling, isn't it?
Absolutely. Guy, we don't have long, but if you could just give us a quick update about the campaign in general.
Well, it's quite an interesting one because the HDZ is generally the party of government in Croatia. It's conservative, nationalist, fairly right-wing. But there's a strong challenge coming from President Zoran Milanovic, who says he's going to be a prime ministerial candidate for the main centre-left coalition, despite a constitutional court ban on him doing so. And that's absolutely lit up the campaign. He's been throwing out insults left and right, mm-hmm. and the Social Democrats' standings in the polls have been going up and up as a result.
Guy Delaunay, thank you very much indeed. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Vincent McAvinney, Tom Webb and Laura Kramer. Our researcher, George Ruskin, and our studio manager, Steph Chungu, with editing assistance from Lily Austin. After the headlines, there's more music on the way, and The Briefing is live at midday in London. I'm Georgina Godwin, and I'll return on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow. Thank you for listening.